It's 36 degrees in New York City as we approach 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Taking Aim with Ralph Schulman and Maya Schoen at 6 p.m. A report of the day's news with the WBAI news team. We're at 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored and commercial-free, and we're on the Internet. That is, WBAI is on the Internet at WBAI.org. Stay tuned for Taking Aim.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schulman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, December 10th, 2002. Within a month of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, according to the Washington Post, December 1, 2002, the first Bush administration launched what became known as Operation Tin Cup. The Washington Post calls it a frenzied round of diplomacy aimed at getting U.S. allies to help pay for the war with Iraq. As a result, the bill to American taxpayers for the direct costs of the Persian Gulf War, a desert storm, was about $7 billion, a fraction of the actual cost. Today, the situation is very different. On Taking Aim today, we're going to discuss what price genocide. In particular, there was a report done by the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It was founded in 1780, and it includes a membership of 3,700 American fellows and 600 foreign honorary fellows, many of them Nobel Prize winners, and particularly many bourgeois economists, such as Paul Samuelson and his co-author of the standard economics textbook, Economics, William Nordhaus, a professor at Yale University. And William Nordhaus did a study called The Economic Consequences of the War with Iraq. But this study, which noted that the war in Iraq could cost up to $2 trillion. $2 trillion, the annual budget of the United States. This study was not noted in the press, or if it was, such as in the Washington Post, it was buried.
Without any of the consequences drawn, and let's be clear about this, because both Paul Samuelson and William Nordhaus are the paradigm of bourgeois economists who have put forward since the 50s the thesis that there is a competitive capitalism and a vibrant free market that defines capitalism without reference to monopoly, imperialism, oligopoly, and the real character of imperial capital control over the past century. Notwithstanding that, what's significant about this study, as you indicate, Maya, is that these very conventional and conservative economists have put forward the documentation for trillions of dollars of cost. $2 trillion is their beginning estimate. It's only an indication of the classic exponential increase of hidden costs for war and predation that have characterized every major war that the U.S. has undertaken. They put it forward as a fraction of what the real cost is, human and economic.
On October 11th, 2002, the Committee on International Security Studies, CISS, of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences held a meeting to discuss what national security policy was and gambling on war. And the important article, the important piece written by William Nordhaus on economic consequences with Iraq was published in part in the December 5th, 2002 issue of the New York Review of Books. Yet, when the Associated Press put out a story, there was just a brief five-paragraph piece in the Chronicle, and as I said, it was buried in the Washington Post, didn't appear in the Los Angeles Times, and not a word in the New York Times. And what these people have noted at the American Academy is the United States has had a major shift in its policy. The U.S. defense budget today is larger than the combined defense expenditures of the next 25 largest militaries. And that the U.S., with its new national security directive, has decided that it would have complete hegemony over all military, over all other nations in the world.
The formulation, Maya, in this study, which is a real revelation about the nature of this permanent war policy of the regime of Bush and with his democratic subordinates, the United States' overwhelming preponderance of military power over any other nation or any plausible combination of nations. The reach and striking power of U.S. forces must far outmatch those of any others, singularly or combined. The United States will strike with speed and accuracy unheard of but a decade ago. A crude indicator of U.S. dominance is, as you indicate, that the combined defense expenditure of the largest 25 military establishments in the world will not begin to approach the U.S. annual budget, which will be increasing on an annual basis.
As Bush had stated in his national security strategy document, the United States intends to build and maintain its defenses, quote, beyond challenge. Beyond challenge. Note, he said also, America has and intends to keep military strengths beyond challenge. It is this U.S. military that must be, quote, strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. Permanent war and predation on the peoples of the world. What is the cost? What is the cost to the people of the world, and particularly what is the cost to people in the United States? That is why it is very important that each and every one of us look at these economic consequences.
But Maya, actually, the economic consequences that flow from this are based not only on overwhelming imperial dominance, but on what the document describes as the keystone element of the imperial policy now in place under this new national security strategy, what is called preemption. That is to say, anticipatory strikes against any potential opponent. And it is indeed an opponent defined as anyone who harbors opponents of the United States. In particular, preemption is translated, as the document states, quote, as preventive war, a war of choice and opportunity to prevent the emergence of any opposition to the United States now or in the future.
Let us look at William Nordhaus's The Economic Consequences of War with Iraq, which you can get on the internet at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences website. What Nordhaus begins by noting is that all estimates of the cost of war are way off base. In fact, Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury estimated that the direct costs of the war to the North, that's during the Civil War, would be $240 million, or 7% of the annual gross national product at that time. But the actual costs to the North turned out to be $3.2 trillion, 13 times the original estimated cost. But that's only to the North. If you look at what happened to the South, if the devastation was much greater, because the entire capital stock of the southern part of the United States was destroyed, and the output per worker was depressed for nearly a century.
And those consequences, of course, were part of the real underlying thrust of the Civil War in the United States, which was the determination of Northern capital to defeat the mercantile interest of the British Empire in utilizing the agrarian South as its source of supply and of sending its own merchandise and mercantile export to the South. It was the continental hegemony of capitalism, which transformed slave into wage slavery, and which took as its human cost the devastation of that region to the point where it could not reconstruct itself except on northern capitalist terms. Every war of predation is based upon the decimation of the infrastructure of the mass of the population, under whatever rationale, to then superimpose the predatory design of pillage of the conquering imperial power. So in the Civil War, so with Iraq. Just one moment to indicate, Maya, what this study shows. It states Iraq is strikingly small, weak, and vulnerable. Its population of 22 million is less than 10% that of the United States, and large portions of the Iraqi population are in a state of total disintegration. Iraq's estimated 2001 defense expenditure of $1.4 billion pales in comparison to the U.S. growing defense budget in excess of $300 billion. Iraq's defense is 0.5% of the U.S. defense budget. It is even a more minuscule proportion of defense spending of the coalition that will take up arms against it. Iraq's economy is similarly vastly smaller, with its estimated 2001 GDP of $15 billion compared to a U.S. GDP of $10.2 trillion. The U.S. economy is 700 times that of Iraq. In short, the quote in this report, the power of the United States is staggering compared to that of impoverished Iraq, leaving many outside the United States mystified as to why Washington is so obsessed with a minor power whose wealth and power have been truncated totally by internationally imposed constraints. This is a devastated, impoverished, weakened country with a starving population, with millions of its children dead from sanctions, and even the surrounding countries. This report is extraordinary in its delineation of what an onslaught is being prepared against the people of Iraq by this superpower. Never in the previous annals of predation has there been such an extraordinary disparity between the attacking power and the victim power when the war is to be as sustained and destructive as this one. Iran and Turkey, both bordering on Iraq, are much larger powers. Turkey is 3 times the population and 10 times the GDP, 5 times the defense expenditure, 50% more men under arms than Iraq. Iran, 3 times the population, 6 times the GDP, 3 times the defense expenditure, 50% more men under arms. Israel outspends Iraq by tenfold, with all the weapons of mass destruction about which this cynical ruling class prates and prattles. Not only is it a question here of receiving American military technology, which is, by the way, calculated today at $1.3 trillion in the past 30 years, and that's only a fraction of the actual subsidy of the Israeli state, but the nuclear weapons capacity and the biological weapons capacity of Israel is massive compared to its non-existence in Iraq. Even Saudi Arabia, with a population identical in size to that of Iraq, has a GDP 12 times that of Iraq, and a defense expenditure 17.5 times those of Iraq. Even a Kuwait, with less than 10% of Iraq's population, has a GDP 3 times that of Iraq, and 5 times the estimated defense expenditure of Iraq, this tiny little feudal construct, Kuwait. To present Iraq as a threat to anybody with supposed weapons of mass destruction is a lie of a Hitlerian dimension, when the feudal countries surrounding it are multiples in expenditure on arms, in GDP output, and in overall size of economy and capacity to that of victim Iraq.
Why war? Why war is clearly stated by the U.S. Energy Information Agency. In a review that it did in 2002, although it didn't say why war, it really gives you the very basis for this war. Because as noted by the United States Energy Information Agency, an agency of the federal government, Iraq has about 10% of the world's oil reserves and resources. In fact, quote, Iraq contains 112 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, the second largest in the world behind Saudi Arabia, along with roughly 220 billion barrels of probable and possible resources. Iraq's true resource potential may be far greater than this, however, as noted by the U.S. Energy Information Agency, as the country is relatively unexplored due to years of war and sanctions. Deep oil-bearing formations located mainly in the vast western desert region, for instance, could yield large additional oil resources, but have not been explored. Now, you can see that also on the internet when you go to government documents. But as Nordhaus then concludes by just doing simple arithmetic, Iraq's oil resources could satisfy current U.S. oil imports, which are 8 million barrels a day. Iraq's oil resources, I will repeat, could satisfy current U.S. oil imports for almost a century. So, why war? Control of this oil. Now, if you look back at the first Persian Gulf War, Nordhaus points to a comment by Secretary of State James Baker at the time of the first Bush administration. He was asked on Frontline on a program that's on the internet again, January 1996. He was asked what was the reason for the first Persian Gulf War, and he stated, quote, jobs, jobs, jobs. But he was later asked what he meant, and he said, quote, the fact of the matter is that it would have boiled down to jobs if Saddam Hussein had been able to control the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf, or to be controlling his own oil and Kuwait's oil, and it would act in a way to influence prices. The inevitable conclusion, as Nordhaus himself notes, so perhaps Baker was really saying that the reason for the war was, quote, oil, oil, oil.
And that oil, oil, oil has been carved up in advance by the United States amongst American oil companies with huge, multi-billion, indeed trillions of dollars of profit projected over any extended period of time, and as the first step towards the destruction of OPEC, in a sense the recolonization of the region and the destruction of even a sharing with the ruling Comprador pass-through regimes of the proceeds and the benefits of this imperial conquest. Although the report says reliable statistics on the Iraqi GDP are available, it averaged about $25 billion in the 1990s. The sanctions reduced the Iraqi oil revenues by 6 years of GDP. The total cost of the Iraqi economy was greater than that. Overall, the war and sanctions of the Saddam regime cost Iraq the order of two decades of GDP in lost output, capital, and financial resources. And the report states there are no parallels in modern history to the economic economic devastation on that scale. Economic statistics, the report states, are too abstract to capture the grim reality on the ground in Iraq. To capture the impact of economic decline on a day-to-day basis, of day-to-day life, we have to understand the following, the report states. While the accuracy of statistics demonstrating the impact of sanctions on Iraq cannot be fully measured, their impact has been devastatingly severe. Infant mortality has doubled from the pre-sanction era. A five-fold increase in mortality amongst children under age five. Kwashiorkor and marasmus, symptoms of severe protein deficiency seen only in mass famine, are common throughout the country. According to the World Health Organization, quote, the vast majority of Iraq's population has been on a starvation diet for years. The Food and Agricultural Mission to Iraq in the summer of 1997 found that 25% of young men and 16% of young women are in chronic food and energy deficiency because of the reduced availability of food over the past 7 years.
Now, what we're going to go into with the Nordhaus studies is the cost, the $2 trillion cost to the people in the United States. Now, this doesn't calculate, as Ralph is going into right here, what is the cost to the Iraqi people. Now, the actual cost in terms, not in money, but in terms of lives from this upcoming war, has been calculated by the prestigious MedAct, which is the UK, the United Kingdom affiliate of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. They did an important study that you can see on their website, www.medact.org. They did a study that calculated that at least 500,000 people, Iraqis, will die during this war, and that it can come up to a range of almost 4 million people.
The New Scientist analyzed this report on the 12th of November of this year, and the New Scientist concluded that at least 500,000 people will die, civilians in their vast majority, as a consequence of this attack. 260,000 will die in the conflict and in the three-month period afterwards, and a further 200,000 from famine and disease consequent upon this vast attack. This, by the way, this report called Collateral Damage, which was published in 14 countries by MedAct, has indicated as well that it is anticipated that nuclear bunker-busting weapons and the depleted uranium and the possibility that both the United States and the Israelis will be testing out micronuclear weapons in Iraq as part of the overall Pentagon design to test the new stream of genocidal weapons will raise the potential ultimate casualty rate in Iraq to 4 million people. This is a genocide, whether 500,000 in short term or 4 million people overall. It is a genocide by war criminals, this ruling class, that calculates their trillions of profit at the cost of millions of lives in this small country alone.
Now, what MedAct also did, now remember, this, these are respected scientists, physicians, and their report has been lauded, it has been acclaimed throughout Europe. What they look also at is the environment, that the widespread damage to the environment of Iraq and possibly the neighboring countries, as we've seen in Iraq with the use of depleted uranium and the effects on not only the Iraqi people but the effects on the Gulf War veterans. And what has also been well documented is what happened in ex-Yugoslavia, in Bosnia, and in Serbia with the depleted uranium entering the aquifer. As well, if oil wells are fired, that can create oil spills and toxic smoke, such as what happened when the oil wells were set on fire during the Gulf War in Kuwait. Troop movements and landmines will destroy the fragile desert ecology. Bombardment not only kills people, destroys building, but it destroys the topsoil and also the depleted uranium, as we mentioned, and the other chemicals that the United States has used, napalm and phosphorus and the many other chemicals that they have been developing, destroy the topsoil and the aquifer. And also there is again the pollution of the land, the sea, the rivers, and the atmosphere. But there's also a global impact, the impact on neighboring countries of refugees escaping the conflict, dying in large numbers, and putting a strain on the neighboring countries, making an emergency relief that can cost billions. And This is expected, as with the devastation, people are fleeing to Jordan and to other countries. So they go into the global impact. The country being left in ruins, the destruction of the roads, the railroads, the homes, the hospitals, the factories, the sewage plants, which happened during the Gulf War, such that the UN Undersecretary Mata Artasari said that Iraq was put back into medieval times. The shortages of water, food, and energy resources lead to epidemic diseases that result in more deaths than those caused directly by the conflict, so that it creates a humanitarian catastrophe that engulfs the already weakened and unhealthy Iraqi civilians who have had to live under this devastating UN-imposed, at the behest of the United States, sanctions.
It was a genocide specifically in regard to the destruction of all water facilities in Iraq. And that was part of a Pentagon plan prepared prior to the last Gulf War. They destroyed potable water. They destroyed uncontaminated sources of water by design across the country. And then with the imposition of sanctions, over half of the rural residents in Iraq after the sanctions had no longer any access to drinkable water. 50% of the rural population. And within the cities themselves, potable water was constantly contaminated by sewage and by the depleted uranium and other weapon consequences, the radiological consequences, the metallurgical consequences of the vast array of weaponry that was inflicted upon the cities, permeating the aquifer, as you say, and affecting all water supply in Iraq.
So going back to the Artasari mission of 1991, where they had actually called it, they said it was near apocalyptic results on the economic infrastructure of what had been a fairly highly urbanized and mechanized society. Now, most means of modern life support have been destroyed or rendered tenuous. Iraq has, for some time to come, been relegated to a pre-industrial age, but with all the disabilities of post-industrial dependence on an intensive use of energy and technology. That was the conclusion of the United Nations with a mission led by its Undersecretary Mata Artasari in 1991. Now, we talk about direct health impacts, but what isn't discussed and what has been found to be true in most war zones, matter of fact, in every war zone, is the mental health of the people involved, the amount of people who cannot cope with what has been happening to them. And the other cost of the human war, aside from the actual death and devastation, is the fact that the educational institutions are destroyed, and so that an entire generation of youth is without schooling or without adequate schooling. So these are the costs. These are the costs to the people of Iraq. And now let's look at, again, what the costs are to the people in the United States, upon whose shoulders the cost of this devastation of the peoples of the world is going to be borne. Remember, as we said, in the Gulf War, with Operation Tin Cup, the United States government got the Kuwaitis, the Japanese, and other people involved, and the Saudis, the other people involved in their so-called coalition, to bear the direct costs of the Persian Gulf War. Aside from the direct cost to the Iraqi people. But in this war, the $2 trillion will be borne by the people of the United States, and it is already happening. So let's look at what these costs are going to be.
Well, Maya, there is another aspect, too, which we shouldn't fail to highlight, and that was the study that the Wall Street Journal described on the 27th of November, new battle theory will be tested in Iraqi invasion. The first thing Saddam Hussein's field commanders will discover in the opening moments of a U.S. attack is they can no longer track aircraft. Their radar installations will be decimated by Hellfire missiles and laser-guided bombs. Shortly after that, 2,000-pound satellite-guided bombs will slam into radio relay stations. They will cut fiber optic communications lines. They will destroy Iraqi communications from the top to the bottom. The lights in their command posts will flicker and fade. Electricity-conducted carbon filaments will rain down on the country's power plants, shorting out transformers and cutting power to the entire society. This opening night scenario is emerging as the central part of the Pentagon's war plan. The outlines of how the U.S. will carry out this attack have been prepared for months, and consensus has coalesced around a plan that calls for a vast and quick buildup of forces and an attack aimed at an immediate devastation of the entire country. By contrast, Pentagon officials said that more than 80% of the bombs in the new Iraqi war will be precision munitions, allowing the military to strike far more targets throughout Iraq than in the campaign of the Gulf War.
Ralph, we should note that now they're saying that they didn't use precision weapons in the Gulf War, but at the time of the Gulf War, they were proclaiming over and over again that their weapons were precision weapons, but what was later revealed is that the so-called precision weapons didn't hit their targets.
Well, their targets are anything that moves. And as the Wall Street Journal article states, during the Gulf War, one aircraft carrier would destroy 162 targets a day. Today, that same carrier, armed with precise satellite and laser-guarded bombs, will strike 700 targets in the same period, while unmanned planes such as the Global Hawk and Predator circle over the country for 48 hours at a time, taking pictures of everything that moves. New satellite communications know that the surveillance allow the surveillance planes to transmit these pictures in seconds to attack helicopters, bombers, and advancing troops.
What price genocide that this is. Taking aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, December 10th, 2002, on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio. You can reach us at our WBAI voicemail, 212-209-2953. That's 209-2953. Or you can write to us at our email, takingaim@pacbell, that's P-A-C-B-E-L-L .net. takingaim@pacbell.net, or by snail mail to our post office box, Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V as in Victory, A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591. We'd like to hear from you about comments about Taking Aim, questions, and also for copies of this program and other programs and our many books and pamphlets. Again, our voicemail is 209-2953. In the 212 area code. Now, Ralph, in talking about this battle theory, which is called effects-based operations and is the pride of Dick Rumsfeld. It's
Donald Rumsfeld.
Excuse me, Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld, and is really a problem for the Army, because the Army is then made to rely upon all this bomb of targets and then send in the troops. So the Army and the Marines are still in favor of a more traditional war, because it's their asses that get kicked, and essentially they're the ones who die as they go in, and all this intelligence and all this bombing hasn't done its purpose. But what are the what are the people who benefit from this war? If you go to the Department of Defense, it lists the contracts of over 5 million day by day. And just in the last few days, over 3 days in December, December 2nd and December 5th, Lockheed Martin Naval Electronics and Surveillance Systems Surface Systems in Morristown, New Jersey, was awarded over $200 million in a cost-plus award fee for a naval sea system operation. And that's just a tip, because if you look almost every day, you're going to see Lockheed Martin getting $50 million or more in contracts from the Department of Defense. But if you go to November 14th, you see that a joint venture of Boeing and Sikorsky got over $6.5 billion as part of an order for the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Command. As you know, Sikorsky produces the helicopters, and this is for the RAH 66 Comanche. Now, in our program Why War, we had gone into Major General Smedley Butler's analysis of the profits of war, and he was referring to the mega profits by all corporations, not just these so-called defense, which we say the war machine, like Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, Sikorsky, and Boeing, but also other sectors, such as the clothing manufacturers, the food manufacturers. And you can see on the Department of Defense website, for instance, UniArt, which is in New York City, got an $8 million contract for polyester wool men's coats. And if you even look for paper bags that you get from your grocery store. Doro Bag Manufacturing in Florence, Kentucky was awarded $6 million to deliver the paper grocery bags for the commissaries. Or Coastal Pacific Food in Stockton, California got $37 million for delivering food, and this is only for bases in Japan, Singapore, and Diego Garcia. So you can imagine, if you talk about a military of the 250,000 reservists being called up, plus the hundreds of thousands of soldiers throughout the world, how much this means in terms of food supplies and clothing and health care and so forth, as well as all the veterans' benefits. For instance, Delta Dental signed a $1 billion contract with the government just for the dental care over the next 5 years.
What we're describing here, Maya, is a garrison state, because we're going to be discussing in this program today the destruction of the social infrastructure and the economy that services the American people. Substituted for this is an economy based upon permanent war. Substituted for this is the cannibalizing of the resources of this society and deploying all resources and economic activity for war production, which is a profit engine for the defense contractors, the war contractors, the oil corporations, and this tiny elite that commands them. And one of the aspects of this, too, which this article in the Wall Street Journal illuminates, is that in every one of these wars, they test out on the population an entire new generation of weapons of mass destruction, of genocidal weapons. And it's interesting that the concept of this effects-based operation that you described is centered in, quote, the black hole, the top secret Air Force planning cell in Saudi Arabia that orchestrated the Gulf War air campaign. And it describes how from that black hole, a whole new generation of weapons of total devastation are being prepared for testing and use against the people of Iraq.
Where do they also do these exercises? As we've mentioned, throughout the United States with the urban warfare exercises, as well in Jordan, in Africa, in Qatar, in Dubai, and in Poland. The Wall Street Journal refers to Victory Strike, the recent military exercise that was done in September to test out the so-called effects-based weaponry. They always have these terms that make it sound as if there's a separation between death and devastation and this technology that they're using. So let's go to the cost. Now, recently in the news, we saw that Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and economic advisor Lawrence Lindsay were summarily fired. But what wasn't noted was that Lawrence Lindsay was there was distance placed between the Bush administration and his comments when he had said to the Wall Street Journal recently that the cost of the war in against Iraq would be $100 to $200 billion. Even that level, and this was assuming an occupation of Iraq, when he made that comment, immediately the administration said, "We haven't even decided to go to war." And Lindsay had actually said that he considered that going to war was the best way to keep oil prices in check, was a short, successful war on Iraq, and that begins sooner rather than later. And the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post are now saying that it was those comments that sunk Lindsay's ship as a member of the Bush administration team. And in fact, the Democratic section of the Congressional Budget Office the CBO, they did a study. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Committee, which is a nonpartisan committee in the federal government, they did a study of the cost of the war. But when they examined it, they only looked at the actual cost of transporting troops to Iraq, the cost of maintaining these troops, the cost of the equipment, because what they said is the cost of the military is a cost that U.S. government assumes anyway. And they only looked at a very short-term deployment. That is an occupation of 2.5 to 3 months in Iraq, when everyone from Colin Powell to others is saying that the occupation of Iraq will probably be 10 years. After all, they occupied Japan for 7 years, and as Nordstrom notes, we are still in Korea. More than half a century later, there are still 30,000 troops in Korea, over 50 years since the Korean War, the intervention in Korea. So when the CBO says the cost is about $50 billion, they are not really looking at the actual cost of this war.
Actually, Maya, that functionary, Paul O'Neill and his associate, who began to discuss the $200 billion estimate of the cost of the war, which as we have seen, is about 10% of the actual cost. But even the reference to $200 billion, which exposes the ways in which the ruling class intends to strip the American people of their safety net of social services to pay for this war predation in Iraq was enough for these people to be removed. They were removed because they were signaling to many in the country that there would be a huge cost for this war, which might not be so easily absorbed by the American people, absorbed, imposed, but devastatingly so, on their daily lives. And one of the consequences of this panoply of policies is that they have brought back as the point man for Iraq none other than Elliot Abrams. As the New York Times described it on December 7th, Abrams is back in the capital fray at the center of the Middle East battle. The pugnacious conservative, the passionate advocate of Israel, no stranger to Washington's policy wars, now has been made the director of Middle Eastern affairs, plunged into the sharpest disputes in the nation's capital. Mr. Abrams' appointment, the Times says, thrilled those who have criticized the administration for being too tough on Israel dismayed those who want Israel to ease its crackdown in the West Bank and Gaza. But it goes far beyond the West Bank and Gaza. For Abrams is revealed as the figure who we know from the Iran-Contra period, but who was behind the scenes in the United Nations to insist that the formulations in the resolutions were such that no matter what the resolution stated, the U.S. would have a basis for attacking Iraq. And in foreign policy, and in its particular document, Foreign Policy in Focus, on December 6th, the meaning of the appointment of Abrams is spelled out. The Iran-Contra figure has been appointed to the region's top policy spot in the National Security Council. He's not just a point man from the Middle East. He's now in the top spot in the National Security Council. He opposed the Oslo peace process. In his book, The Present Dangers, which was produced by the Project for the New American Century, he outlined a Middle Eastern policy that called, and this is in the year 2000, for immediate, quote, regime change in Iraq and for the elimination of the Palestinian Authority. He is to the right of Netanyahu, who he attacked publicly for making concessions to the United States in giving lip service to negotiating process with Palestinian counterparts. The role that he will play is in particular, as this document points out, in regard to the occupation of Iraq.
Now,
he will be the point man for the occupation of Iraq. This person, who is slightly to the right of Genghis Khan, Elliot Abrams, is going to define the destruction of the Iraqi infrastructure on a civilian basis and the capturing of its oil resources in perpetuity.
Yes, because according to the New York Times, October 11th, the plan is to put General Tommy R. Franks, the commander of the United States forces in the Persian Gulf, or one of his subordinates, to assume the same role that General Douglas MacArthur served in Japan after its surrender in 1945. And they feel that they must put an American officer in charge in order to prevent a civil war, because as they noticed, without U.S. troops and a large force of U.S. troops, there wouldn't be control in Iraq and there could possibly be a civil war. This is the plan of the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency that have noted that in Afghanistan, where they put Karzai, their man who formerly had been working for UNICAL, in charge, in fact, you have warlords controlling most of Afghanistan, and the U.S. is now being pushed to set up protected so-called security zones. Now, what is the cost? What is the cost of having these soldiers, U.S. soldiers, in Iraq? The actual cost that's calculated based on the U.N. peacekeepers in Bosnia is $250,000 per occupying soldier per year. So tie this in with the Abrams control. You have the U.S. looking at a $500 billion cost over the next decade for just a peacekeeping operation in Iraq as a real minimum.
As the point man for the occupation, there's a very particular aspect to the appointment of Elliot Abrams. He is replacing Zalmay Khalilzad, who will now become the, quote, ambassador at large for free Iraqis, and he'll play, quote, the key role in sorting out internal conflicts under Iraqi opposition. And both Khalilzad and Elliot Abrams are the signatories of the 1997 founding statement of the Project for the New American Century, which is the document of this Likud Mossad clutch of Wolfowitz and Armitage and Pearl. And to understand what it means for the occupation of Iraq, I think it's important to recall here that Elliot Abrams is the person who coordinated the death squads. It's interesting that, and I'm speaking here of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, during the period of the Contra War. And the Reagan administration had made this man the secretary, Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. But Human Rights Watch and Amnesty documented that he covered up, quote, horrendous abuses committed by U.S.-backed governments and their death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala, as well as in Angola. So what we have here is a murderer, and a man who is going to utilize his point position in regard to the occupation of Iraq to eliminate people on the ground, assassination squads to kill people who are opposed to U.S. policy, people who have any aspiration to control over their own society, Shiite leaders, Kurdish leaders, working class leaders, anybody on the ground. If we think that the regime of Saddam Hussein has been repressive and brutal, when Elliot Abrams is in charge, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, Ralph, it's interesting that you mention the connection between Abrams and Wolfowitz, because on October 3rd, there was a report in the online journal, The Cheney Plan for Iraq, Chop It Up and Give Away the Pieces, by Bev Conover, and what she was referring to were reports that appeared in Pakistan's News International, which was reporting on analysis by Stratfor, which is a strategic forecasting think tank in the United States that is well known for its intelligence reports. And according to Stratfor, the Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz plan for Iraq is very different from that of the State Department and the CIA. The State Department and the CIA see a long-term occupation and maintaining a unified Iraq. But Wolfowitz and Cheney, as according to Stratfor, see a fragmentation of Iraq.
In other words, the Oded Yinon plan of the Mossad that we have described in the Hidden History of Zionism, and which has defined the policy since the 1970s of Wolfowitz and Gene Kirkpatrick and this entire neoconservative clutch of conspirators who see the Arab nations as a target for fragmentation. The Oded Yinon report of the Mossad called for the fragmentation of Iraq and of each Arab country in turn into its ethnic and religious components, and the parceling out of their resources amongst fragmented entities that will be totally operated by the United States and Israel through surrogates. This is the 30-year design of this ruling class core that has now seized control of policy in the United States.
According to Pakistan News International's reporter, the plan authored by U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney was first discussed in an unusual meeting between Crown Prince Hassan of Jordan and the pro-U.S. Iraqi Sunni opposition members in London in July of this year. And that plan would call for the area around Baghdad to be ceded to Jordan, for the southern part of Iraq, the Shia section of Iraq, going to Kuwait, and for the autonomous part, the Kurdish part, to be an autonomous state with very strong presence of U.S. military bases. And, of course, the would be much U.S. Military buildup in Jordan itself, too. So, and would be called the United Hashemite Kingdom, because if you remember, when you go back to the monarchy in Iraq, it was the brothers, the Hashemite brothers of Iraq and Jordan, who were put in place by the British.
Yes, as U.S. imperialism backed the Wahhabis of Saud for the conquest of Arabia and its subordination to U.S. control, Winston Churchill carved out Transjordan as a favor to the Sharif of Mecca and the Hashemite who were replaced by American imperialism. And one of the brothers, as you the sons of the Sharif, King Faisal I, was installed as a British-controlled stooge Carthage monarch in Baghdad, and the other was in Abdullah was installed in this newly created entity carved out of Arabia and Iraq called the Transjordan. And these figures were holdovers of British imperialism, soon displaced by the United States, and they were in an area that had been promised as the nationally liberated Arab nation by Lawrence of Arabia as the device to enlist the Arab resistance to colonialism and direct it against the Ottoman Empire, after which the British and the French carved up the region between them, and the United States after World War I displaced both and began the process of consolidating American imperial control, for which the Zionist state and the creation of a colonial settler entity in Palestine was the linchpin, the vehicle, the force on the ground to threaten the Arab revolution and to prepare for the fragmentation not only of Palestine but each Arab nation in its turn. It is unfolding today. It is a long-term design, and the people who have been its primary conspiratorial advocates are now in control of the state apparatus of the United States.
You know, Ralph, over the 20 years I've been listening to you talk, I am still amazed when I hear you, because you have a way of bringing everything together, and you've done it once again. And also, we have a way, both of us, of preparing two-hour shows instead of a one-hour show, so we still haven't gotten to what is taking place exactly in the United States with the cost of war. So in this last minute, let me just point to a part of the Nordhaus study where he says, economic expansion were constant companions of war, and this was the iron law of wartime booms that was caused by large wartime increases in military expenditures. And he looks at World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War, but he says the iron law of wartime booms ended with the first Persian Gulf War. And he says the public sector provided little expansionary impetus, and what we're going to see now is a real collapse in the U.S. economy. Well, the short war has little positive input impetus, and the threat of war has been crushing the United States economy and actually the world economy, along with the dot-com debacle, which is really the overexpansion of the technology market, and the corporate scandals, which are revealing that they're really tissues of corporations, that they're all based on speculation and deceit rather than on real production.
Maya, the Federal Reserve Board last week indicated that the U.S. Central Bank shares the fears of a renewed recession and worse, and the Institute for Policy Studies has published a document which demonstrates that this war fever is weakening an already ailing economy. That is the context for the privatizing of 850,000 jobs amongst federal workers. That is the meaning of 1 million people losing their benefits before December 28th, 1 million workers to be followed by 2 million more. That is the consequence, which leads to a fiscal crisis, according to the New York Times, in every state in the United States. The governor's report speaks of plunging tax collections, soaring medical costs, the destruction of social services in every state across the country.
The details of which we will go into in another Taking Aim show. Remember, you can contact us at 212-209-2953 or takingaim@pacbell.net.
And brothers and sisters, as we describe the reality on the ground, the genocide, the conspiratorial intent of this tiny rapacious ruling class that has brought us 9/11, that uses weapons of mass destruction to prepare us for war, we should remember, as Shakespeare told us, how we should confront our enemies, how we should speak the truth to power, how we should not accommodate them, we should not cover for their war on terror, we should not find excuses for it, we should not legitimize it, we should not grant the pretext that there is some sort of terrorist cabal that threatens the United States when it is the U.S. rulers themselves who are terrorizing the people. Oh, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am meek and gentle with these butchers. Let us not follow that course. Let us resist them. Let us overcome them.
This is Taking Aim
with Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week.
And that phone number, once again, to get in touch with Ralph Schoen and Maya Schoen here in New York, is 212-209-2953. That's Taking Aim at pacbell.net on the Internet. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up in a moment will be a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team. And at 7 o'clock, Tahrir, Voices of the Middle East in the U.S. and abroad with Barbara Nimriaziz. And on today's program, Tahrir will focus on Iraq with several exciting new interviews, including a talk with British MP George Galloway. That's at 7 o'clock. At 8 p.m., Asia Pacific Forum, Jazz Sampler with Bill Farrar at 9, from 9 until 11, and Pacifica Radio's Peace Watch at 11 p.m. We are WBAI at 99.5 FM, and we are on the Internet at WBAI.org.
Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Well, we hope that you will be there. We'll have to update that card because it's not after the news right now, although we hope that we will bring back the news rebroadcast at 11 p.m. But in any event, Pacifica Radio's Peace Watch at 11 p.m., followed by the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. At 6 o'clock in New York City, please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.